From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history, with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred Turner and I will be talking with Robert James Fichter about his book, Tea, Consumption, Politics, and Revolution, 1773 to 1776.
Fichter says that despite the so-called Boston Tea Party in 1773, two large shipments of tea from the East India Company survived and were ultimately drunk in North America. Their survival shaped the politics of the years ahead, impeded efforts to reimburse the company for the tea lost in Boston Harbor, and hinted at the enduring potency of consumerism in revolutionary politics.
Tea protests were widespread in 1774, including here in South Carolina, but so were tea advertisements and tea sales. The protests were noisy and sometimes misleading performances, not clear signs that tea consumption was unpopular. Colonists supported patriots more than they abided by non-consumption. James, we're delighted to have you on the Journal today. Before we get into your book, which I found fascinating, let's talk a little bit about you. First of all, you're a professor at University of Hong Kong, but you know about grit, so where did you grow up and where did you go to school, that kind of thing?
Thank you for having me, Walter. I was born in Connecticut and raised in New England, went to school at Harvard, so I didn't learn about grits there. I enjoyed traveling to South Carolina for research along the way, and I've had the pleasure of speaking at the Old Exchange just this past December. And of course, I availed myself of South Carolina's loveliest delicacies while I was there.
Oh, well, good. And of course, you obviously spent some time down in the cellar where one of the shipments of tea was there for a couple of years.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about the tea parties.
And I'm so glad you're here because when I was reading the description of your book, several things I read puzzled me because I'm like most anybody else who went through secondary education and even a degree in college in South Carolina. I thought, tea parties, plural? And why tea became a political, did it become a political football? Is that a good way to put it?
Yes. I was surprised to find so many tea parties as well. There were copycat tea parties in many ways. After the Boston Tea Party, other protests that occurred in other cities often referenced that, or especially after the Parliament punished Boston for the Boston Tea Party. With the Boston Port Act closing the Port of Boston, tea protests in other cities, including in Charleston, by the summer of 1774, about 6 months after the Boston Tea Party, really became as much more than anything else, protests of Parliament's treatment of Boston, and it became part of a sense of fellow feeling. But Charleston had had its own affair with tea simultaneously with the events in Boston, and they happened really disconnectedly from what was going on in Boston. The travel times between Charleston and New England and New York could take a week or two, and so it wasn't really practical to coordinate. And so the politics of tea resistance and boycott and protest in Charleston proceeded differently, and severally. There were three at least different tea protests along the way in Charleston in 73 and in 74. Well, actually, four of them I can think of. And so this became a rolling and ongoing issue.
You've got the Tea Party in Boston, but when tea comes aboard the ship London to Charleston, South Carolina's various committees, which had been formed to protest British rule, decide they don't have they didn't even know about a Tea Party, but the tea that they were blocking from being sold was put in the basement of the Exchange, still belonged to the East India Company, and it stayed there till 1776. Now, the British officials, as you point out, realized that this was still a slap in the face. In New York, something else had happened, but the officials in London decided to make Boston the example rather than Charleston or New York. Is that because they just were always ticked off about what was going on in Massachusetts?
Yes, in part it was exactly that. Anti-parliamentary, anti-ministerial protests against different acts and laws coming out of Parliament had been ongoing since at least the Stamp Act in many colonies, including in the Caribbean, not just to the 13 colonies we think of today. But the protests in Boston had been especially severe. There had been this sequence of protests and riots, the Liberty Riots in 1768, the Stamp Act riots a couple years before, the Boston Massacre in 1770. We think of it now as a troop shooting on an unarmed crowd, but the ministry was more wont to think of it as a crowd picking a fight with soldiers. The Boston Tea Party was just one more in this litany of events in what seemed like an especially rebellious city. And so the ministry thought, well, what we need to do is just make an example of the worst behaved colony and the worst behaved city. And then once we've taught them a lesson, the colonists and all the other cities and towns and colonies will shut up and toe the line and it won't be a problem. So they were offended by what happened in Charleston and was described as an offense. The events in Philadelphia, where the tea ship arrived there on Christmas Day, was simply turned around and sent back to England, was also considered offensive by Lord Dartmouth, the Secretary of State for the colonies. But they chose to single out Boston as a political choice, to focus their ire on that one point, and therefore hoping that when Boston fell, the other cities and towns would follow.
See, that's what was so important in terms of South Carolina history, and of course, I think other colonies as well, is when those four acts were passed, which the colonists referred to as the Intolerable Acts or the Coercive Acts, but there were actually four separate acts just very quickly. The Boston Port Act, which closed the port of Boston until the destroyed tea was paid for. The Massachusetts Government Act, which altered the Massachusetts frame of government, banned town meetings. The Impartial Administration of Justice Act, which sounds pretty long, but if you were a British official accused of a crime in a colony, you could be shipped back to London to be tried instead of being tried in the colony. And then the Quartering Act, which says if we've got troops and need a place to put them, we'll take your house, Alfred Turner, and that's just too bad. You've got to put up with it. Well, South Carolinians reacted rather vocally to those particular acts, because if it had happened to Boston, they rightly understood it could happen in Charleston in South Carolina.
Exactly. And the survival of the tea in Charleston, because the East India Company had sent tea to four cities, to Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Charleston in 1773. And Boston alone had tried to destroy its tea. New York and Philadelphia turned it around, and in Charleston, the customs collector locked it up. But that the survival of that tea, meant that there was this lingering possibility of the conflict over the tea could spring back up and bring all these exact issues down over Charleston. And so it seemed like wherever Boston went, of all the other cities and colonies, Charleston, South Carolina was the one that seemed perhaps most likely to follow because of the continued holding of East India Company tea and the risk it could either be offered for sale by the customs collector. He had the company didn't own the tea anymore. It had been seized by the crown, but the crown could offer it for sale and the company's men could buy it back and sell it, or that further legal action would happen in Charleston as it happened in Boston.
Well, see, now that's an interesting point that you just made. The tea no longer belonged to the East India Company. The reason it was in the customs house in the basement is the customs duties had not been collected, right?
Exactly.
So Charleston's leadership, and it's still very, very important, not just the backcountry doesn't really count much at this time. They had already been having problems with the folks back home on appointment of officials, on how the budget was to be managed, funds to be spent. And so they were very leery of anything coming out of London. And you cited all the newspapers. They were saying if it could happen in Boston, it could happen here. This also leads in Charleston to not just protests, but the forming of a special committee, a general committee that will eventually evolve into an independent government by 1776.
You know, the funny thing about that is when they formed this committee, in early 74. They actually included one of the merchants who had been assigned by these India Company to handle its tea in Charleston. And I've not quite figured out why and how he was included. My best guess is he was included. He was the most patriotic of these three merchants. And I think he was included in order to keep an eye on the others and also to try to bring them in. So Charleston's a success story in a lot of ways. And Boston's a failure because the Boston Tea Party happened because politics didn't work in Boston. There wasn't a way to negotiate a solution to the problem. But in Charleston, they succeeded in negotiating a solution. They let the customs collector land the tea. This was what the Boston Tea Party was supposed to avoid. And then it stayed locked up. They weren't terribly worried about it being offered for sale. They trusted they could come to some sort of understanding to keep it locked up and to prevent further problems from emerging. So it's striking. I'm not quite sure how they pulled that off, as partially getting the consignees on board, but also the customs collector seems to have been willing to go along as well.
Later on, there is a shipment of tea to Charleston that gets destroyed. But by that time, so many other tea parties had happened that, as you mentioned, they were just copycats. And
by that time, all bets were off, right?
Yeah, and there had been there was a shipment that came on the Britannia in November of 74, and that tea was destroyed. But in November of 74, Charleston had had this massive Guy Fawkes Day celebration in which they had this very large float going around the town that was heavily festooned with tea, with Governor Hutchinson, oddly, the by then deposed governor of Massachusetts, and Lord North, with tea canisters abounding, with the devil and the Pope instructing them on this platform about the evil doings they must do.
The devil and the Pope.
And then this float is burned in this sort of bonfire in the evening. It's a strange celebration. We don't celebrate Guy Fawkes Day in the United States anymore. But it was this sort of very patriotic, British patriotic event that South Carolinians were participating in. And they were burning tea in it, in this protest, and saying that their cousins back in Britain should be as good Englishmen as they were in supporting their rights. But when tea arrived, when new tea shipments arrived at that time, of course, they were burned. Or sunk in the water just to demonstrate, for the importing merchants to demonstrate that they were well-behaved and they weren't going to try to upend the emerging political sentiment by importing more tea.
One thing that you point out, and I think it's extremely important, is it wasn't the fact that tea cost more with the levy that was placed on it, because Americans were smuggling Dutch tea, which cost them more money, but it was kind of the principle of the thing.
Yeah, you know, that's just it. The East India Company tea, yeah, the people could buy on principle, but they could buy on principle on both sides, right? South Carolina had a track record of small but reasonably sustained importation of duty tea from England, fully paid for and taxed in 1771 and after the previous boycott ended, and in 72 and in 73. So there was... People could, on principle, you know, obey the law and pay their taxes, which is usually seen as a principled thing to do. We sometimes forget that actually that could actually be principled. And then people could, on principle, defy the law and evade their taxes by doing smuggled tea. But of course, when people evade their taxes and say it's on principle, you have to sort of wonder, are they avoiding paying their taxes on principle, or are they avoiding paying their taxes because they just want to avoid paying their taxes?
And yet they were willing to pay more money for the smuggled Dutch tea than they were for the...
Yeah. I mean, the smuggled Dutch tea was cheaper initially before the tax cut in 73. And after, well, we don't know how the East India Company's tea would have sold because it wasn't sold. So, it's an open question how well the East India Company's tea would have fared against the Dutch tea. That's the question you're pointing to. And people have speculated on both sides of it about how well it would have done. The English company set a ceiling on the price that they would sell it at in order to try to flood the market and push the Dutch tea out. But the tea was never available for sale. I suspect you're right. I suspect that the Dutch tea would have been positioned to be more expensive and been at a disadvantage in the market because of that. And so buyers would have had to buy smuggled tea purely for the philosophical principle of it, not out of any self-interest. But they never really had that. That trade-off never really came to pass because the tea got locked in the exchange.
Well, another thing that you point out is we've got lots of myths about the boycott of tea. You know, the ladies of North Carolina not going to drink tea. But you point out is that people kept drinking tea. They may have been boycotting it, but somehow they got it and they drank it.
Yes. I mean, you know, I struggled with how to write about it and talk about it in my book, because the first few times I started to encounter this, I thought it was some great triumph that I discovered that the people were hypocrites. But, you know, I'm an adult, so I've learned that people are hypocrites in general, and it's not news in some ways. But it is news, because we sometimes have a little bit of a fantasy that goes on about the American Revolution, where we imagine that people are in some way more unapproachably distantly earnest and resolute and principled than us. They could be venal and self-interested and narrow-minded and brave and principled and proud all at the same time. And so lots of people would swear their political principles and say, we support the revolution and we're absolutely not drinking any tea. And then they would go out and buy some and drink it at home. And so they would say one thing and do another, but that's normal. I even found local politicians who would be in charge of the Revolutionary Committee that was supposed to enforce the boycott, who would be secretly selling their own supply of tea on the side while they did that.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked.
Pennsylvania and New York and Georgia. You know, again, it's not shocking when you start to think about it. That was a corrupt local politician.
Of course,
I mean,
Georgia, what do you expect?
This.
I mean,
Georgia. Now.
It was just one of those things that I thought when you pointed that out that, people were hypocritical about it. They didn't give up their tea for dandelion wine or whatever that they used in other circumstances.
We can take it a step further and say that actually the fact that they were hypocritical makes them relatable to us and makes them like us, that they're understandable. I don't want to blame them.
Yeah. Well, as events, of course, unfolded from this to non-importation associations locally and then from the Continental Congress, it's very interesting because they were going to have an embargo of colonial products going out. Well, mm-hmm. South Carolina's delegates to the Continental Congress said, wait a minute, we're going to keep shipping our rice or we're going to go home. And so South Carolina got an exception. It's not the first time that South Carolina said, okay, boys and girls, we can play by our rules or are we going to leave.
Take my ball and go home.
Yeah.
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 And that's a great point, because that's obviously a moment where there's this trade-off between economic self-interest and political principles. You know, it's possible to sort of find a way to rationalize and say the two somehow go together. And South Carolina would do that in the future, certainly. But it's worth noting, right, that this can be rational political bargaining, right? This is how politicians still make decisions in Congress today whenever they do actually manage to pass a law, right? They say, well, wait a minute, I want to benefit for my state or we're not passing this. It's really not that different in a certain way. But the funny thing about that, right, is that it doesn't really assume that independence is coming. It assumes that the trade relationship with Britain would resume in the future. Because if the trade relationship with Britain isn't going to resume, there's no need to try to get an accept rice for Europe line, like you pointed out. Yeah. And the boycott isn't much of a threat if it's never going to end. You have this sort of still this implicit assumption that they're part of this British economic empire, whatever else they might be a part of.
That's right. It's just like if you study later part of American history, we talk about the antebellum period. Folks mm-hmm. in Charleston in 1860 didn't know they were antebellum. They weren't even looking at war in 1860. So the point that you just made about we're doing this within the British Empire and how we're going to make them squeal and come to senses. Of course, that didn't happen.
No, but you know, it's funny because South Carolina stood out as one of those colonies that actually could have made a difference in terms of making them squeal. So that, you know, might have had an impact, but the whole boycott was so delayed. They talked about different reasons for this. One reason was there was a parliamentary election in 1774, and the goal was to use the boycott to put pressure on merchants in Britain who would put pressure on MPs and affect the vote in the election, and therefore that this might turn colonial policy in their favor. But the boycott wasn't implemented until December of 1774. And the response of most colonists when news of the impending boycott came out was, of course, to stock up on goods, just like we all did during when we first heard that COVID was going to happen. And so people went out and bought large supplies of goods. Merchants reported about a 30% increase in shipments from Britain to North America in 1774 because of the impending boycott. So people were just stocking up. And so whatever economic effect the boycott was supposed to have on Britain was delayed until at least 75, because it didn't happen until December of 74. And of course, they bought so much stuff from Britain already that they'd just given an economic benefit to Britain by expanding the colonial market, in effect, by buying more British goods. There was no the hit in terms of the boycott in the British economy would have taken several years, perhaps, to even manifest. So the real effect of the boycott, I don't know how much people thought it would be at the time, but the real effect was to unite people amongst each other within the boycott, to create a common cause and fellow feeling among boycotters, among associators, as they called themselves. The economic consequences of it were not at all what were expected.
And of course, there were always people who asked for exceptions. There was a notorious case in South Carolina where the Charleston Committee enforcing the boycott agreed to let a very wealthy planter import his horses from England. And then when word of that spread, they had to retract that permission.
There were exceptions. And on top of that, the structure itself was syncopated. So the non-import began in December of 1774, but non-export, even for goods like indigo that were boycotted, didn't take effect until September 10 of 1775, so nearly a year later. So there was all this time when merchants could still export goods from South Carolina back to Britain or to Europe. And this was kind of the point, because in order to get access to the real business, which was shipping South Carolina plantation crops back to the British mercantile world, you needed to behave and not import British manufactured goods when your ship arrived if you wanted your ship to leave with a viable cargo. So there's an example of a tea ship that arrived in Virginia in November of 1774, brought a little bit of tea, and it wasn't really in that sense a tea ship. It was a tobacco ship. It was going to came with a mixed cargo, unloaded it, and wanted to just load up with tobacco and go back to England. And the Patriots in Yorktown, Virginia, decided to board the ship and destroy the tea cargo, throw it overboard. And then to punish the merchant, they said, "We will not let you load tobacco on the return voyage." And this is what really got him to change his mind. And the merchant was John Norton, one of the biggest merchants from London trading in Virginia. He'd married into Virginia plantocracy and was well connected there. And he was groveling and apologizing in the Virginia press and promising that he would abide by the association and the boycott. And then as a result, subsequent ships of his were all loaded with tobacco in 1775. So this became a political lever in certain ways to stagger these two events.
Well, and the enforcement of the boycott, non-importation, non-export, devolved upon local committees in South Carolina, and that was not just public pressure. They would publish lists of who was not abiding by the rules, but it also kind of morphed over into violence, tarring and feathering. Mm-hmm. And this was going on before 1776 in Charleston.
Yes, there was definitely a violent element to it. And also, like you say, because it was devolved into local neighborhood committees, for your parish, for your region. The politics of it were very intense and local. You would have a group that might go door to door asking people to sign, not asking everyone, but usually asking householders, heads of households to sign. Although in South Carolina, the boycotts are distinctive in that they did sometimes ask women to sign as well. But the boycotts would then, when you get this list and you're supposed to sign, you can see your neighbors on the list and you recognize their names and you might recognize who's not there. And you also can reflect and realize that your neighbor down the road will see whether you've signed when the committee men leave your house and proceed on. So how do you want people to think of you? Do you want people to come to your, to buy your farm goods or come to your pottery shop or listen to your sermons in the future? Or do you want them to treat you like an outcast? And so the social pressure was intense, and it was intense because it was so local and it was amongst people that they knew. And this made it quite potent and then reinforced by violence when needed at times in order to bring things along, especially in the South Carolina case, especially in the backcountry, in regions that had not, in the early committees and conventions in 1774, many parts of the backcountry hadn't participated at all. Or if they had participated, it had been with an appointed delegate. I think in the June or July 1774 convention or meeting, I think there were delegates appointed to represent the backcountry, but there wasn't anyone present. So they had to subsequently go out and essentially evangelize the revolutionary movement into the backcountry. And they ultimately had some success, but they also needed a lot of violence to get it to work.
Well, you mentioned the fact that women signed in South Carolina, and one of the reasons was the large number of women who were femme sole traders that could actually operate under their own names once they had gotten the legal paperwork done. Small shops in and around Charleston. In fact, a majority of the taverns in Charleston, the owner, the official owner that had the license, frequently was a woman.
So. That's interesting. And they also had a distinct social role, South Carolina being by far the wealthiest of the 13 colonies. South Carolina ladies, elite women, planters' wives, had a distinct elite social role that hadn't been as fully evolved in frontier colonies like Georgia or East and West Florida or parts even of North Carolina. And so there was also this elite role for South Carolina women, and that would also be very Charleston focused, right, around their townhouses in season. And an ability to be choosing and deciding, what you serve to your guests at social events, and to set a leadership role with other women in the community. So I suspect that the story of South Carolina women in this still has more to be told.
There are certainly, beginning in the 1730s, letters, poetry in the South Carolina Gazette, which of course is owned by a woman by this time, protesting against the strictures imposed upon them by society. So the fact that South Carolina women signed the protest, the boycott, I think is significant.
Mm-hmm. And they write major, there's a lot of letters and essays in South Carolina papers by South Carolina women, or sometimes also they're bylined by South Carolina women. One of the problems we have is we don't always know that the people who bylined their names as women were actually women. Benjamin Franklin would sometimes write under a female pseudonym if he wanted to give a specific piece a female voice. He would write with a fake woman's name and write in. Silence Duguid, for example, was one humorous female character he would use when writing. But certainly, some of them were definitely women writers, and they were participating in politics in a meaningful way. And the boycott gave women, one of the things that's been long been an appeal in talking about these boycotts has been the way that the boycotts could give non-jurors a way to participate in politics, whether you were a woman or whether you were a man but below the property qualifications, or even age restrictions, depending on where you were. Or racial restrictions, if you could afford to buy a consumer good and you chose not to, you could therefore engage, and you chose not to out of a boycott, you could therefore engage in politics, even if you didn't have the right to vote in a political election. And so this has been an appealing way for historians to think about boycotts. But of course, there's another side to that, and that is that when people choose not to consume goods and to protest and to hold back, that's very hard to sustain. And I think there's one way of thinking about boycotts that's very proud of boycott history and proud of the resistance of it. But if we look at the long lines of boycotts that have preceded in the last 250 years, many haven't been successful because they're very difficult to sustain. People lose their energy and motivation to stick with it for month after month or year after year. And without effective organizing, they tend to fall apart. And in the American Revolutionary case, one of the problems with this boycott was the Patriots could easily end up being in the position, or could easily have ended up being in the position, of seeming like they were immiserating the population, right? If the population felt like it was being forced by the Patriots into giving up consumer goods and basically accepting a lower standard of living simply to make a philosophical point, that might not have gone over so well. But it was helpful that the Patriots were willing to let the populace promise to give up these consumer goods, but then look the other way when the populace subsequently went along and consumed them, because by 1775, the war is going on. And so as long as you're joining a militia unit or you're supporting the defense of Charleston, in the South Carolina case, no one really cares whether you're drinking tea or wearing British cloth along the way, as long as you're shooting British soldiers. These details matter a lot less.
I hate to say this, gentlemen, but we're getting close to the end of our time here, so we need to start wrapping up.
Okay. Before we do, Alfred, one thing I didn't ask James is I was fascinated, first of all, with your book, but then the fact that you're on the faculty at the University of Hong Kong. How did you end up there?
I finished my PhD in 2006, and I came out to Hong Kong. I was initially at Lingnan University then, which is a different university here in Hong Kong. Was there for 7 years, and then I was lucky to find an open slot at HKU, and was able to move over. Oh, it's been a great pleasure to be here. It's, I think I lucked out, because if you do a PhD, you see people who succeed and they go on to universities at Berkeley, and then you have friends who aren't able to find a job anywhere. So it's been wonderful to work somewhere like the University of Hong Kong that really supportive of its faculty, supports our research, funds it well, gives us time to do our writing and do our research travel. So it's been a really good ride.
Is that a publicly funded institution?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Alfred indicates that we're going to need to wrap things up. Any last word for our listeners before we sign off?
Well, I guess I could say, the Boston Tea Party came and went, and the Charleston Tea Parties came and went, but ultimately they all ended with people deciding that despite the protests, they were going to just drink a cup of tea. and it's funny that it didn't add up to the big national movement people kind of hoped it would be.
James Fichter, the author of Tea, Consumption, Politics, and Revolution, 1773 to 1776. Thanks so much for being with us today from Hong Kong on The Journal. I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. With his broad understanding of the tea trade and tea consumption, James Fichter has been able to chart the rise and fall of tea as a politically important symbol. And it certainly was. The Boston Tea Party led to what we call the Intolerable Acts or the Coercive Acts, where British government and Parliament decided to punish the town of Boston and the colony of Massachusetts for their actions. In South Carolina, leading figures who were in the tea boycott and also in government noticed and said, if Boston can be punished and Massachusetts can be punished, so can Charleston and South Carolina. This led to the formation of various committees that would eventually result in an independent government in South Carolina in 1776.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. Remember, the views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.